start.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mike. So I'm going to talk basically about two topics which are related to turbulent convection. The one is sketched by this figure. It's about the boundary layers in high Rayleigh number convection flows. And then if there's some time left, I'm going to talk a little bit more about what happens if you really go to extended convection flows, large aspect ratios, and what kind of things we do observe there. So I will throw in a lot of things which we are currently working on right now. So some of these things are not fully digested, but I think that's perfectly okay for this workshop. Before I start, I want to announce there's a Euromesh colloquium this summer on turbulent superstructures in open and closed flows. It will take place in Erfurt, actually in a monastery right in the middle of the old city. And we will have the conference dinner at the Wartburg, which is an UNESCO World Heritage landmark. And just for those who are interested in history, this year we have actually 500 years of Reformation of Church. So this is Martin Luther. And he actually was a young priest in this monastery. And then when he was banned by the Catholic Church, he had to hide at this castle. So here are the invited speakers. And it's organized by Bruno, George Haller, and myself. And more details are found at this webpage. Okay, so as I said, the talk will be consisting of two parts. One is related to the boundary layers and one to the large scale patterns. And usually, since it is forgotten at the end, I'm just mentioning all the people who are involved in these studies. At first, Janet Scheer from Occidental College in Los Angeles. So we have done most of the analysis over the past 5 years on that subject together. Then some former postdocs of mine who are now spread in the Max Planck ecosystem in Germany, Vinod Bandaru and Mohammad Emran. And I will also talk a little bit about some analysis which we're currently doing with Dimitris Giannakis from the Courant Institute. And these are my current collaborators in Ilmenau. So most of what I'm going to talk about is related to very massive numerical simulations. I would like to set the stage. First, what are we talking about? Well, in thermal convection, you usually have a layer of fluid which is heated from below and cooled from above. And you have basically three parameters that set the stage. It's the temperature difference between the bottom and the top plate. You have to consider the properties of the working fluid. How is viscous diffusion related to temperature field diffusion? That's done by the Prandtl number. And since in experiments you don't have an infinitely extended layer of fluid, the geometry parameter, which usually is the aspect ratio, the horizontal extension in relation to the height of the layer, comes in as a third parameter. The system responds with the fluid motion, which becomes turbulent in the bulk relatively quickly. And so we have a turbulent heat transfer, which is quantified by the Nusselt number. And we have a turbulent momentum transfer, which is quantified by the Reynolds number. So the Reynolds number is the response of the fluid to the applied temperature difference to the thermal driving. Everything is typically condensed in these relations. And as you see in this sketch, in the bulk, everything is turbulent and well mixed. The boundary layers are the crucial aspect in this system. All the heat which is applied from the bottom has to go through these boundary layers, which get thinner and thinner as you increase the Rayleigh number. So it's really a loophole, and the question is, when can this loophole be opened up a little bit such that the heat transport is more efficient? So here's a typical experimental system. We have a closed cylindrical cell. In this case, it's filled with liquid mercury, a liquid metal, which is a very good heat conductor. And you see the temperature field always to the left and the velocity magnitude to the right. You see at this rather low Prandtl number, the temperature is very diffusive. The structures are very blurry, while the velocity structures are much more finer, have finer striations.
Sorry, you said experimental. You mean experimental?
Well, experimental means that's the typical setup in laboratory experiments.
Okay,
but in the simulations as well. So because we eventually would try to compare with experiments. Yeah. So
in our... are we seeing results from experiment or results from simulation? I'm just trying to...
We see results from simulations.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and we just saw a horizontal cut through the system. Good. So the question is really, how is the dynamics in these boundary layers? And we are really talking about this region here. So this is at the edge of the cell. So here's the sidewall, the bottom plate, the plumes are going up. And the next one is a midsection of the heating plate, so which looks much more ambient compared to the sidewalls. Things are moving from left to right, as you can see here. And I'm just waiting for the next sequence, which is close to the heating plate. And you also see already how this structure seems to change direction while we are watching this animation. I'm coming back to this.
What's the Prandtl number for mercury?
0.021. So the big question is, as I motivated already a few times, is there actually this transition from a laminar-like boundary layer to a turbulent-like boundary layer? Everything here is already fully turbulent. If you do Kolmogorov spectra, etc., in the bulk, everything is turbulent, but by far not in the boundary layers. And this has consequences, or might have consequences, should have consequences for the behavior of the turbulent heat transfer. It is expected that the scaling changes if you go into this so-called ultimate regime of turbulent convection, an idea which goes actually back to Bob Kraikner from the early 60s. Is this transition a gradual one? Is it more or less a sharp one? It's all very highly debated and also very controversial over the past decade, and I'm not going to get into this particular aspect here. So I'm getting back to our simulations. We always stick in the Businesque approximation. So we are solving this set of three-dimensional equations. As I said, our setup is corresponding to a typical experimental setup. We are taking as characteristic units the height of the cell, the temperature difference, and the free fall velocity, which is composed of acceleration due to gravity, thermal expansion coefficient, temperature difference, and height. The sidewalls are thermally insulated, and we have isothermal top and bottom plates everywhere, no slip walls. And here are the exact definitions of Rayleigh, Prandtl number, and aspect ratio. And these are the exact relations, the kinetic energy balance, and the thermal variance balance, which you can derive in the statistically stationary regime. The Nusselt number is calculated in this way. So the only correlation which matters is the one between the vertical velocity and the temperature field. The Reynolds number is calculated by the root mean square velocity, which is set up in the system, and the Prandtl number is given here as the ratio of the kinematic viscosity to the thermal diffusivity. It's basically a comparison of two time scales, a diffusion time scale and a viscous time scale. The boundary layer thickness, the average boundary layer thickness for the temperature field can be directly related to the Nusselt number. And for the viscous boundary layer, it's already a little bit more complicated in the sense that this definition, as I have given it here, would imply that the boundary layer is more or less laminar, this typical square root over Reynolds scaling. And but that's one possible definition. I'm coming back to this later. So why is it interesting to go into different Prandtl numbers? Well, because the ratio of the thicknesses of both boundary layers changes dramatically with respect to each other. We have a very thin boundary layer which is well embedded in the temperature boundary layer for very low Prandtl numbers. The fluid turbulence is extremely vigorous. We have strong inertial effects, while the temperature field is very diffusive in that regime. It's exactly the other way around in the high Prandtl number case. So we have a very small temperature diffusion. The boundary layer is very thin in comparison to the viscous boundary layer. Our main focus is on those two. So we started out here, and we are now systematically moving into this direction simply because many of the applications which people have in mind when they talk about convection are actually in this regime. Many people forget to state this. If you think of solar convection, if you think of convection in the liquid metal core of the Earth, if you think of stellar convection, it's all this part here. Yeah, no this and neither this. So that's what I'm going to talk about in the next minutes. We are applying a spectral element method. This is a typical element mesh in a cylindrical cell. On each of these elements, you are expanding your turbulent fields into so-called Lagrangian interpolation polynomials, which are consisted of Legendre polynomials. And the collocation points are chosen as the Gauss-Lobato-Legendre points. And here's just an example for the highest simulation which we obtained in liquid mercury. We had to use 500,000 of MPI tasks. These are 6.3 million elements. And on each element, in each space direction, we are expanding the fields up to an order of 11 in terms of these polynomials. So here's the data set which we have generated over the past 5 years. So there are five orders of magnitude for convection in air. It's all for aspect ratio 1 cells. So the height is as large as the diameter. And here are our data for liquid mercury. And I'm just indicating the largest experiment, laboratory experiment, which has been conducted for that liquid. And that goes back to Masaki Sano. By that time, he was still in Sendai. 1999, they made it almost to 10 to 11 in a convection cell in liquid mercury. So as you can see, we are still far away from 10 to 11. In sodium, liquid sodium, which has an even smaller Prandtl number, it's the smallest Prandtl number you can get in a laboratory experiment on Earth. It's 5 times 10 to minus 3. We are actually doing already better than the experiments. The last experiments have been conducted in Karlsruhe in a typical Rayleigh-Dinard setup. Up to 2 million, we are currently at 5 times 10 to 7 here. If I would plot the experiments for Prandtl numbers around that one of air, so then I would have to draw the sketch here. As you know, there are experiments in Göttingen and in Brno, which go up to 10 to 15, and there have been experiments in Oregon, which even went up all the way to 10 to 17 in helium or in compressed sulfur hexafluoride. For some discussions, it was also interesting not to go along constant Prandtl and Rayleigh numbers, but also along constant Grashof numbers, which is the ratio of Rayleigh over Prandtl. Yeah.
So what are the Prandtl numbers for the liquid helium and the, I guess, the sulfur hexafluoride?
It's all 0.8 around. Well, it depends. If you go to the critical point of helium and you really cool down things, then there's actually a drift in the Prandtl number, which causes some of the discussions. Yeah, but at least in Göttingen, they managed to keep the Prandtl number around unity in compressed sulfur hexafluoride up to 10 to 15. So that is about the order. Yeah. Okay. So every talk in convection starts with a plot of Nusselt versus Rayleigh or Reynolds versus Rayleigh. And here are our data, log-log plot, turbulent heat transfer and turbulent momentum transfer. You see just by looking at the magnitude that the heat transfer is becoming less and less efficient. If you decrease the Prandtl number, Nusselt drops down. Contrary to that, we see that there's a strong enhancement of the fluid turbulence if you go to these low Prandtl number fluids. And these are the data points. So they look pretty nice. If you present them in a log-log plot, you can also do a power law fit. Here are the exponents. And at least for the data that we have collected so far, there's a very systematic trend. Things start out of 0.30. That's something which most people agree on for this Prandtl number, and then it seems to slowly decrease the exponent towards a quarter, which is actually a threshold which was predicted by an asymptotic theory by Fritz Busse in the 80s. So that seems to be at least consistent with what has also been observed in laboratory experiments here. There's also a variation in the Reynolds number, which is given here. But as always, if you be honest enough and you plot everything in a compensated plot, you see that there are always little trends in the data. In particular, you see it here. There's a drop, and that point pretty much causes this exponent to lie here, to line in with the other ones. You also see here that it seems to level off. And so it's one always should be cautious. There's no perfect scaling, although these log-log plots look already pretty good. But one should never forget about a compensated plot to illustrate things. Okay, let's take a look at the boundary layer. So what I'm showing you here, we are now at the bottom plate in one of these higher Rayleigh number simulations in liquid mercury. And the streamlines, the field lines, which I have plotted here, are actually field lines of the skin friction field. So we are taking the two derivatives that survive at the plate. It's the derivative of the two tangential components with respect to the wall normal coordinate, and we are plotting these field lines. And you see that the boundary layer has already a very complex structure, which is by far not any more than laminar in a certain sense. We have an impact region here, and that simply comes because we have a closed convection cell. There's a large-scale wind filling the whole cell. It hits somewhere the bottom plate, and that's exactly here. Then the stuff gets swept over the plate. That's this region here. And then it has to go up again because we are in a closed cell, and that's basically what happens here. And just to illustrate, if we put on top of it the vortical structures here just identified by a Q criterion, you would also agree, I hope, that this is something which is probably not fully turbulent, but nevertheless, it's by far not anymore something which we could call laminar. So now the problem is, or now the idea was the following one. What we did is, or what we want to do, is we are going into the center of this boundary layer region. We are avoiding areas where we have this impact and where we have this ejection. And we are putting ourselves into a perspective of a classical wall-bounded turbulent shear flow, and we are trying to analyze the data from that perspective. And that's exactly what I'm going to talk about. Well, there is one problem with that, and the problem is that the flow permanently changes direction. There's nothing which nails down this mean flow, this large-scale flow, because we have a homogeneous direction in the azimuthal with respect to the azimuthal coordinates. So we will have these impact regions jittering around here. Things are swept over, and then it ejects here again. And it was a little bit visible in this animation, which I showed at the beginning. So we have to get rid of this effect. And what we did is snapshot by snapshot and horizontal plane by horizontal plane, we determined this mean orientation in the interior section of the, above the plate. And then we are basically rotate all our velocity fields into this direction, which gives us a streamwise direction, a spanwise direction, and okay, the wall normal direction remains as it is. And the same for the coordinates. And you have to keep in mind that this large-scale flow structure is in another sense also very complicated. Namely, if you look at the same time at the top plate, where everything should be statistically completely symmetric to what's going to happen at the bottom plate, you will detect another direction. So there is a torsion in this large-scale structure, and it has an extremely complex dynamics. And this is our suggestion to remove this complex motion from the data. Then we can define a friction velocity. We can define an inner viscous scale.
Yeah, and we set the time scale for these changes of direction of the wind.
Well, what we did here in this analysis is we did this just snapshot by snapshot. So for each snapshot, we just determine the instantaneous direction. And the snapshots for the statistical analysis are separated so by at least the free-fall time.
But from the physics, what side of the scale of the change of direction? Is this normal?
No, well...
what time scale is there?
The time scale, that's a good point.
Gunther Anders has about 100 papers on this.
Okay. Yeah, but this is, well, yeah. Yeah, but that what he does is he is always reducing it to a planar dynamics, yeah. And then they are doing a little, basically an extended oscillator model for that. And what we always see is that this is by far more complex. I mean, it's a real 3D structure, and so it is probably a nice cartoon of what's going on, but probably doesn't tell us the whole story. So the variations, that's what we checked, is about tens of freefall time units if you are looking at the angle. But on top of that, there's a very slow variation as well. Yeah, and so if you wait very long enough, everything should be averaged out, actually. So, and this variation time scale somehow probably has to do with the time which a fluid parcel takes to loop around once in the big cell, because when we did some Lagrangian studies in the convection in these cells, we saw that the looping time is something like 10 to 20 free-fall time units. So that's my answer. It's probably not that's what where we are currently. So, okay. So here are the log profiles which we determined in the inner section of the plate. And so here are our five Prandtl numbers. This is all at in liquid mercury. If you repeat the same analysis in air or in sodium, it looks very similar. We have just taken this one because it gives us the highest Reynolds number, which we have so far in our data record. And we actually took this highest Reynolds number and compared it with a simple, with a classical channel flow at the same Reynolds number. The friction Reynolds number is something like 80, so we are pretty low. And it's indeed some transitional flow. Here is the definition of our friction Reynolds number. Since we cannot use the half width in this convection cell because the profiles are actually decreasing again, so what we did is we took just we took just the maximum of this of these profiles. This is the delta star, and then you you plot the ray tau versus Rayleigh, and you you ask yourself, well, when do I get to something like 200, roughly, where everybody knows, since Kim, Moyne, and Moser, that things should be turbulent, at least in a channel, then you get to something like 10 to 11. It's exactly where the experiments of Sano stopped. So, yeah, that's the current state. So, now some data. How is it looking for the other Prandtl numbers? And we can do the same for air, and then you get a Rayleigh number, a so-called critical Rayleigh number, beyond which things might be turbulent, which is larger, which is somewhere at close to 10 to 13, and that is actually at least consistent with the data and predictions which have been done in the experiments in Göttingen. But then you take your data for Prandtl, 5 times 10 to minus 3, and you see this, actually this behavior. And so the question is, what's going on here? And our current problem is that the smaller the Prandtl number becomes, the smaller the time stepping has to be done, so this the slower you can advance and gather sufficient statistics. So, and at the moment we are trying to sort out this point just to see if this is something which has to do with physics, or is it just that we have not collected enough statistics?
Jörg?
Yeah?
Going back to the previous slide.
This one?
You're the one where you're talking about the law of the wall. So, at low Prandtl number, where the thermal boundary layer is very thin, would we even expect the
thermal boundary layer is very thick.
The thermal boundary layer is very thick. At,
yes.
Okay. That's so. This is a regime where we would expect. Okay. Got it.
The turbulence is very vigorous. The fluid turbulence is very vigorous, not only in the bulk but also in the boundary.
Okay.
So it's very strongly driven by inertia. And the idea is that these very coarse structures of the temperature field, if you think in a picture of a cascade, they inject the energy at a very coarse scale. And then you can show that actually more energy goes down along the cascade, which means that also the Kolmogorov scale, the small end, is smaller. So the range of the turbulent cascade in a low Prandtl number fluid is extended, and we have looked at this by what I said, comparing fluids at the same Grassof number but different Prandtl numbers, so that from a fluid's perspective everything is unchanged. Yeah, it's just that the injection scale into the fluid is different.
Yeah. No, I was thinking of the opposite limit where the thermal boundary layer would be very thin and you'd
yes.
be generating small scales.
Yes, that is, yeah. That is then something which you have, for instance, in Mantle convection,
yeah.
if you go to the Prandtl infinity limit. So
it's a simple way to see why the turbulence is more vigorous.
Well, you look at simply fluctuations of the velocity field. You look at
seeing like, is there a physical reason why at low Prandtl you'll have more bigger?
Yeah, that's what I just tried to explain. So what we have shown actually in one of the papers is that the turbulent cascade, so the pure fluid turbulent cascade, which you can look at and study, is extended. So, which is in line with the larger flow Reynolds number, which we observe. Yeah, you can show that, well, the picture is, as I said, the fluid turbulence is driven by the plumes, and the plumes are thicker, yeah, because they are more diffusive. So that means energy is injected via the buoyancy term at a larger scale. Yeah. And that's basically the picture. Okay, so but I just want to point to the, and these are now experiments, these are the experiments done in Karlsruhe in 1999 in the group of Müller in liquid sodium, and they also see these kind of dips which we observe here. We also see that for the Nusselt number, so it's not quite clear. As I said, at the moment we are trying to understand this, and I have to leave this open for now. Other measures of the behavior in the boundary layer. Here is the friction coefficient, standard one, and we show data over the full plate, which is A, and over the interior section again. And you see, at least for the liquid metals, things become much closer to turbulent boundary layer. To indicate these scaling laws, we have just used the relation that Reynolds is the square root of Rayleigh. So other measures which we have tried is something like a local shear Reynolds number, and we are currently extending this analysis also to the low Prandtl number, so it's ongoing work. And a further aspect is to look to the structures. We actually see these streamwise vortices nicely in the inner section. Here's a blow up, and you see these vortices here indicated in this plot, very similar to, I have just grabbed a picture here from an old paper of Javier. And so the idea is to calculate something like a turbulent fraction in the inner section and to see how that changes with Prandtl number and Rayleigh number. So why do we take this inner section, actually? Well, if you look at the skin friction field and if you look at the critical points of the skin friction field, it's a 2D vector field, you see that most of them are clustered in the outer region. So we have taken a sequence of snapshots, and this is basically an accumulated plot which shows all the positions of the critical points. These are settle points, these are stable nodes or stable foci, and these are unstable nodes or unstable foci. And in the middle, there are much less of these critical points, as we know. As it is the case in turbulent channel flows.
What is a critical point? Is it zero of the vortices?
It's a zero point of the skin friction field.
And yeah. The three things there, what are the things?
So we have the skin friction field, which is basically dUx, dz, and dUy, dz at z equals zero. So this is my two-dimensional vector field, yeah. And for that, I'm going to do the analysis. So as you probably know, there has been similar studies in Melbourne and in Stockholm, and I'm just giving these two references here for completeness. This is the PDF of the derivatives here. Again, our channel flow simulation and here our own data, and that this transformation at least seems to work reasonably well, which we applied, is shown here, because in the spanwise case, all these PDFs collapse pretty nicely. Okay, so what is the picture about the boundary layer structure? And Yeah, this is a mean temperature plot. This is the mean skin friction plot, the mean pressure plot. And we saw that we can divide the boundary layer into three regions. We have an impact region, we have an ejection region, and we have something where it is a high shear region. We saw that most of the critical points are in this outer region related to the impact and the injection. There's a favorable pressure gradient. I haven't shown this, but I'm just mentioning this for completeness in the interior section.
Means are oriented already. I mean, you have done your reorientation.
Yes, yes, exactly. This is basically the mean picture. If you take a sequence of these, it's not that it always goes this. It's just going as we discussed a little. So that is something like the average picture over a certain time interval, which is actually also not too big. It's a few freefall time units. Yeah. Yes, I haven't said anything about the temperature scaling. We have also looked at the temperature scaling. There are old works by Ron Adrian's group from the 90s where they speculated that it is a power law scaling, and we actually see a power law scaling here as well. What we don't see, at least not for those data, is a turbulent boundary layer scaling which follows the laws by Jaglom from the 80s or Kader. So that's not what we see. Okay, and that's what I have said. Good. So in the last 5 minutes, I'm going to talk about the second part, which is no, it's yeah, it's just, I mean, I don't know. It's for almost 45 minutes.
Let's see how long the audience will organize.
Okay, good. Yeah. So in the second part, we're going to large aspect ratios. We are trying to make the horizontal extensions much bigger than the height of the cell. And we know there are many very famous examples in nature. I just give two. It's the solar convection. We all know that solar convection, although we have an extremely high Rayleigh number, is organized in these cell patterns, which we call granulation. And if you even go bigger and do helioseismology, you even can see supergranules. That means an even higher order on an even larger scale. We all know from atmosphere that high Rayleigh number convection also gets organized in very regular patterns. These are cloud streets over the Bering Sea, so the cold air is swept from the land to the ocean, and then we have these patterns. So our point was, do we also see something like that in a classical Rayleigh-Binet setup? And so we did some simulations. These are simulations at an aspect ratio of 50. So we have a diameter of 50 and a height of 1. And we started with a Rayleigh number of 5,000. So we are in this spiral defect chaos regime. The Prandtl number is 0.7 in all these studies. And you see the typical patterns. And then you start to increase the Rayleigh number. You go to 500,000, where things are at least, well, softly turbulent. It's not fully turbulent, but anyhow, the flow is turbulent. As you can see here, it's a close-up look into this section of the plate. This is an instantaneous temperature field in the mid-plane. And then you start to average these fields. So you take a sequence of these snapshots, and you average it over 50 freefall times, 100 freefall times, and you see this picture. So, which looks again very similar to what we observe here. So it looks like that the system has not forgotten where it is coming from, loosely speaking, and that was exactly what we tried to understand better. So here I'm just showing 5,000, 50,000, 500,000, an instantaneous snapshot in the top row. In the middle row, we have averaged over 10 freefall times. And you see here's nothing changing because it's barely time dependent. Here the pattern comes out. Here you still don't see a lot. And then you average for longer. And then you see actually that the pattern here comes out. It looks pretty close to what you would observe here. So we started to look at the velocity fields. So we decompose the field in a Reynolds type way in these systems. And then we are taking something like a root mean square, volume time, and here only volume because there's no time dependence left. And then we are looking how these three quantities at two different Prandtl numbers behave as a function of the Rayleigh number. And then you see that for the low Rayleigh numbers, as you would expect, these are very close. And then at about, and there are almost no fluctuations. Fluctuations slowly grow. And then at about 10,000, there is a crossover point. And that's where the fluctuations become stronger in the magnitude as the intensity of the mean pattern. And that's exactly the region where basically everything which is observed at the top plate gets decoupled from what is observed at the bottom plate. So if you look at these two pictures, it's like this one is a false color picture of this one. Here it is still the case. If you look closer here, it's not anymore the case, although at a first glance it might look so. So the plumes do not make it anymore across the whole cell. And something happens in between, which is related to a diffusion of these structures. Things are starting to get turbulent here. What we did then is, let's define something like an effective Rayleigh number by just taking in a very simple, crude way, something like a turbulent viscosity and a turbulent diffusivity. And we are doing the simplest Reynolds thing you can do. It's just about seeing if the picture works. And then you can define an effective Rayleigh number of these large-scale patterns. And you come up with something which is much smaller. So you take your data for Prandtl 0.7 and 500,000, and you get a much smaller Rayleigh number. So this is a kind of Rayleigh number which you can associate to the mean pattern in the turbulent convection flow. You repeat this for Prandtl 10, and since Prandtl 10 is has much less thermal diffusivity, you get another number which is still larger. But then you can do it repeatedly. It's a little bit like a renormalization group thing which we are trying to do. You always seem to end up with a Prandtl number, a turbulent Prandtl number, which is smaller than 1, which was a surprise to us. Probably has to do with the kind of plume dynamics which we are observing in these flows. And now the idea was to run a DNS at this effective Rayleigh number and at this Prandtl number. It's shown here. And this is our average picture at the original Prandtl and Rayleigh number. And then we compared these two patterns by using the Betty numbers, which Mike Schatz and his group have applied to these convection patterns. And they are pretty close. So that is what I was mentioning here, that the topology of these patterns are comparable. Okay.
I missed something very basic. Sorry, I'm sure you said it. The new star and the Kappa star? You got those from some...
Yes, we got those from...
the right-hand side, the 4500, and deduced those.
Yes. So where should I can... This time I go to this part of the blackboard. So what we basically do is we basically take our convection layer, and then we are excluding the boundary layers, and then we are calculating these numbers by just doing something like ui uj is equal to mu. Well, and then you have to basically do an I, J, K, L, and then So this is a kind of classical Reynolds
explosion. So those over bars mean?
So we know this. This means averages. So we are taking
what kind of mean though?
Eddy viscosity.
No. What kind of average?
Average is over planes.
Horizontal planes.
Yes.
And time. Over no time.
And time. Yes.
Hundreds of free fall units.
Yes. It's very crude.
I just wanted to know where they came.
We didn't want to do anything fancy. We just wanted to see if it works at all.
So you'd expect that the sort of the turbulent Prandtl number should be order one.
Yes. Order one. Usually it's bigger. It's really getting close to one. So we get something which is a bit smaller, and that's partly not fully clear. It might be related also to this very crude approach to the problem. It's really so and currently what are we doing currently we are trying to extend this database and also include different Prandtl numbers. So what I show you here is 10 to 5, which is not that big. The aspect ratio is 25, and this is again a snapshot of the velocity field at these different Prandtl numbers and the corresponding temperature field close to the bottom plate. And when you do now the averaging, and in the temperature case you wouldn't see a lot, so that's why we took the derivative right at the plate. These are the patterns in the same color here given. But what I want to point to is the upper row, where we see again the time averaged velocity streamline plots, and you see that the typical scale of these rolls in all cases is more or less the same. So some of these Prandtl number specific aspects which you would observe if you are looking to other quantities seem to disappear when you are going to this coarse dynamics. So now a little bit about the evolution time scales. We basically have a few of these time scales. That's the one I mentioned already. It's like a large scale eddy turnover time or a convective time unit. We have a viscous time unit, and in principle we also have a time which grows and grows. If you make the cell bigger and bigger, it's the time which is related to the diffusion in the horizontal directions. So, and then some times which are related to some dynamics. I mentioned already this one, trying to reply to Mark's question. So this is a typical time, which a looping time in a Lagrangian perspective, and this is a typical time it takes that such a plume structure locally detaches. So. But what about the very large time scales? And now we are hitting again a wall in the sense that running these large aspect ratio simulations for a very long time might be a little bit of a problem. So we went back all the way to a cubical cell of aspect ratio 1, and we run that for tens of thousands of convective time units. So really very long time. This is a close-up to what you see here. So when the system relaxes in the stationary state, we waited for a very long transient of 5,000 time units, and then we start the statistical analysis. And in this system, it's actually interesting because what you see is that the large-scale flow has some discrete states, and the discrete states, which you would expect, are those which you can see here, always with two rotation directions. So you have these states, and then you do an analysis, and that's work done together with Dimitris, and you look you look how the large scale modes behave in the phase space, and you can actually see that they are clustered in these four distinct regions, and we have checked by projecting the modes back to the flow field that these indeed correspond with these different flow states. And here you see the time scales are a few thousand time scales in which these flow states can be locked. So it's really a long time you have to wait, quite a while. So what happens if you increase the Rayleigh number? We have seen already some pictures in Rodolfo's talk. So here again, you get more and more finer structures. And the question is the system passing through a transition in the turbulent regime? And it might be the case, because this is some older work which we have done in 2010, a much smaller aspect ratio, only 8, but here is a Rayleigh number of 6,000, 10 to 7, and 10 to 8. And you see that you still can relate this structure, mean flow structure, to that structure. But then something seems to change, right? If you go further up in Rayleigh number. So it might be that we also see some changes in the mean patterns if we are able to further increase the Rayleigh number. Okay, good. That is the summary. I have said everything, and I don't need to repeat this. And I just want to put, these are the references for those who are interested. And I want to thank the funding agencies, and I want to thank you for your interest.
Great. We've got some time for questions. So for your, when you have your cylinder of aspect ratio 1, the large-scale circulation is rotating.
Yes.
When you have your cylinders of larger, do the large-scale circulations stay fixed, or do they also move around?
No, they also move, but then it's much more complicated, because what you basically have is you have a few of these roll patterns which always have to move around each other. Yeah.
So, and for a rectangular periodic domain, do they move, or?
Well, in the rectangular periodic domain, they can also sweep across the boundaries, right? And I have never looked at periodic boundaries, but I know you did, right?
Well, Richard is doing it.
Yeah. Well, there is something which is different, and it's really, I mean, no matter how big you make the box, when it is a finite wall, everything has to be arranged with respect to each other. So it gives you a lot more pain if you're doing this with the solid walls. But what we are planning also are some experiments in larger aspect ratios, at least in air, and therefore we prefer to stick with the side walls. Yeah. Okay.
All right, no more questions. All right, let's thank Eric once again. Right.